Our true crime podcast deals with sensitive issues, including some that little ears shouldn't hear. Listener discretion is advised.
This is Cam.
And I'm Jen.
And you're listening to
Our True Crime Podcast.
It'll be Cambo and Jimbo. It'll be fun.
Jimbone and Commode.
No, I don't like that. Wrong. Hi, Jimbo. How are you?
Hi, Camille Ho. How are you?
Oh, my God. I hate you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm good. You ready?
Hi. Look at Reg. He's had enough of your shit.
All right. So.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. It's really nice to have the kids back in school.
It is nice.
Can kind of relax.
I can't wait for October.
Not that I'm getting, you know, the house in shape or anything, because screw housework, but.
I can't wait for October.
I know. And you know what? I've been thinking about maybe we can do a little special ghosty episode in October.
Ooh, I got some good ideas.
I know. Because you can't have true crime without a little bit of paranormal. Yeah,
well, and I think if I'm thinking what you're thinking, there's a little true crime going on there, too.
Oh, there is true crime. I forgot about that.
There sure is.
And monkeys.
I don't know about that, but okay.
Yeah, you do.
Speaking of which, Missouri, I'm going to take us back to Missouri again.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You know what? There's a lot of cases in Missouri. And like I said before, somebody once told me that it shouldn't be the show me state. It should be the shoot, shovel, and shut up state.
Well, I'm telling you.
I know. Vigilante's at his finest.
All right. So I'm going to take you back to the summer of 1960.
Ooh.
In Missouri, there was a body of a woman that was found dead in the woods. Now, this little area was pretty remote. It was called Lover's Lane, or like a Lover's Lane area. The victim had been shot multiple times. Police detectives identified her as Patricia Jones.
Me and Mrs. Jones.
Mrs. Jones. Mrs. Jones. Mrs. Jones. Mrs. Jones. I'm still leaving that in there, too, by the way. So after graduating from high school, Jones married her high school sweetheart, Walter T. Jones, Jr. Walter soon enlisted in the Marines after their marriage and then took the couple to the West Coast while Jones was serving. After his discharge from the military, they returned to the Midwest and settled in Independence, Missouri.
Ooh, I know Independence, Missouri.
I was thinking you'd have a song for that, okay? With their two children. Now, by 1960, almost 5 years into the marriage, Patricia was working as a file clerk for the IRS while her husband sold cars. As is often the case, despite being married with children, Walter had a liking for the ladies. On April 18th, he met a woman named Sharon Kinney.
Okay. I know this case.
So Kinney had come into the dealership to purchase a Ford Thunderbird. You see, Mrs. Kinney had recently come into some money because her poor, unfortunate husband had been killed, and she had the insurance money and was looking to spend it. Kinney and Jones hit it off immediately, and the two soon began an affair. Now, Kinney was eager for a second husband.
Eager beaver.
And Jones looked great. However, there's just one small, small little problem.
Little penis.
Jones was married and had no interest in...
You said I wasn't paying any attention to the case, and now I am, and you're making fun of me.
Jones was married and had no interest in leaving his wife. So Kinney knew she had to bring up the ante. She informed Jones she was...
pregnant.
With child, and he was the... baby daddy. Oh, boy. So
it's
Kinney
the
same expected,
old song, isn't it?
It is, I tell you. So Kinney expected that Jones would fall to the ground, happy and madly in love, and leave his wife in that little perfect dream she had, right? However, no, Jones, he had another idea. He immediately ended the affair and wanted to return to his wife, Patricia. Devastated, but not yet deterred, or else we would not be doing this case,
not
of course.
Exactly.
Kinney knew that she had to come up with a plan. No way was she going to be unwed and pregnant.
Well, it was bad back then.
So on the afternoon of May 26th, Kinney contacted Walter's wife, Patricia Jones, as she was working. Kinney proceeded to tell Jones that her sister, not her, mind you,
was currently having an affair with her husband, Walter.
No. Gasp. Dun, dun, dun. Clutching my pearls.
Patricia agreed to meet Kenny to discuss this matter further that same evening. Sadly, Patricia would never return home. I think that's so skeezy, too.
That it is skeezy.
Why wouldn't you just call and, you know what I mean? Like, if you're going to have the guts to do all that, man up and say you're the one having the affair.
Exactly. Or woman up. Or text them.
Something like that.
Something.
Anonymously.
Mm-hmm.
Walter Jones filed a missing persons report with the police the next day and began calling people he thought might have seen his wife. He spoke to some friends of Patricia's who had been carpooling to work with her in the past weeks. And the friends informed Walter that Patricia had told them about a strange phone call she had received from a woman who wanted to meet with her. Patricia had asked the carpool driver to drop her off at a street corner in Independence so that she could do just that. The carpool friends told him that they had seen the woman waiting for Jones in another car at the shop, but did not recognize her. They described the woman to Walter, and he knew just who the strange woman was. But what he didn't know was what she wanted, or even worse, what she would do.
Oh, now do you think he's like... really worried that she's going to...
Oh, I think he's probably a sweating, but yeah. No way would he think really what happened. So Walter Jones called Sharon Kinney on the telephone and asked if she had seen or spoken to his wife. Kinney allowed that, yeah, she had indeed seen Patricia that day. She had met her to tell her about Walter's affair, but according to Kinney, she last saw Patricia where she had dropped her off near the Jones home, speaking to an unknown man in a green Ford. Now, I think that's interesting that Kinney makes sure to say that she spoke to a man in a green Ford. I mean, why would she do that?
So people could find a green Ford?
Well, she's trying to set up an alibi.
Oh, well.
She never dropped that girl off there. You kidding me? Mm-mm. Nope.
Less information, the better it is.
When you report a crime?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, totally. Don't give the details.
No, because you can never remember the details.
Yeah, that's a giveaway. They always say that to you.
Yeah.
When Walter heard this info, Walter Jones demanded to meet with Kinney late in Friday evening to give him more details about where his wife was and where could she be. Walter later admitted in a rage and in a panic, he did hold a key, I guess threateningly, to Kinney's throat and demanded more information from her.
Oh, I'm sure he was livid.
Oh, you know. After leaving Jones, Kinney's
crazy.
After leaving Jones, Kinney contracted a friend of hers named John Boldies and asked him to help her search for Patricia Jones, which, look at the irony there. She knows where Patricia Jones is. Come on now.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly before midnight and within hours of Kinney's conversation with Walter Jones, she and Boldies had found the body of a woman in a secluded area approximately 1 mile outside of Independence. Boldies would be the one to report the body and claims he was out there by himself and he had to go to the bathroom and stumbled upon the body.
Mm-hmm.
The body was soon identified as the missing Patricia Jones. Jones had been hit with 4 shots from a .22 caliber pistol. Although the fatal wound was a shot to Jones's head, entering near her mouth on an upward trajectory, she also had 1 through-bullet wound to her abdomen and 2 penetrating gunshot wounds to her shoulders on a downward trajectory through her body.
She had one that was going by her mouth heading upwards.
Yes.
And then the ones in her stomach, her abdomen,
mm-hmm.
were all heading down.
Down.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I mean, to me, that kind of...
Well, the one up could be suicide, but yeah. You wouldn't point down necessarily.
No, it's not suicide.
No. But I'm just saying.
No. I think it indicated that she made her get on her knees. That's what I'm thinking. Okay.
Possibly.
Well, I think
it was dropped her to the knees and then...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Powder burns on the hemline of her skirt, which had been raised to her waist, indicated that a gun had been fired from close range at least once. Investigation placed Jones's time of death at approximately 9 p.m. on May 27th. That was the evening she had met with Sharon Kinney. The area in which Patricia's body was found was sort of like a lover's lane, you know.
Earlier.
Hubba, hubba.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, police thought that maybe Jones, a married woman, went there to have a rendezvous, right?
That makes sense. Yeah, I can see where they got that.
Yep. Police pulled in Walter Jones to interview him. During the course of the interview, Jones admitted that he, in fact, was the one having an affair with a woman he had sold a car to a few months back.
So he's putting it together.
Well, the police are.
But you said that Walter admitted that he was having an affair.
Yeah.
So he's...
No, he knows that she did it.
No, exactly. So that's why he's telling her.
Yeah. during the course of the interview, Jones admitted he was having an affair with a woman he had sold a car to a few months back. The police asked for the woman's name. Dun, dun, dun. Kinney. Sharon Kinney. Here's where it gets good, Jen. Can't make this up, I tell you.
Oh.
The police knew that name, and the truth was about to come out. And believe me, you, it was far more unbelievable than any cheap dime store crime novel. I added that last phrase. I really thought I was pretty clever right there, because it's true.
Pulp Fiction.
Sharon Elizabeth Hall, now Kinney, was born November 30th, 1939, in Independence, Missouri. While attending William Chrisman High School, 16-year-old Sharon met a cutie pie handsome boy, 22-year-old college student named James Kinney, in the summer of 1956. The two continued to date until Kinney, a devout Mormon, left to attend Brigham Young University. Mm-hmm. Sharon deeply wanted to escape the Midwest, and she saw a way. She wrote Kinney a letter at school and informed him that she was
pregnant.
She likes that, I tell you.
She does. Hey, if it works.
Wrong. Kinney took a leave from school and married Sharon on October 18th, 1956.
You were born that year, weren't you? Wasn't that around your, was it 2 days after you were born?
I'm going to
cut that out.
Take you out, girl. The couple's marriage license identified 16-year-old Sharon as being 18.
16?
And a widow.
16?
16.
And a widow?
Identified her as being 18 and a widow. Though she later refused.
Was she a widow?
Though she later refused to address the assertion, Sharon told people at that time that she had been married when she lived in Washington to a man who later died in a car accident.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it was
the new
an accident.
Couple held a second, more formal wedding the next year in the Salt Lake Temple after Sharon had completed the process of converting to Mormonism.
Oh, so she did convert?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Sharon got her wishes to escape the Midwest and ended up in Provo, Utah.
Mm.
Not exactly a hustling, bustling metropolis that she dreamed of. That kind of made me giggle because it's Provo, Utah. Well, soon, Kinney left school.
There's a lot of scrapbooking that she could do.
Soon, Kinney left school, and he and his new wife returned to Independence, where they both took jobs. Sharon, babysitting and stuff. Housekeeping. And James is an electrical engineer at Bendix.
Did she have a baby? Oh, so she was pregnant, and he married her, and the baby hasn't come out yet?
My next sentence states, although Sharon claimed to have miscarried the child that had brought about the marriage, she soon became pregnant again. In the fall of 1957, she gave birth to a little girl they named Dana.
Wow.
The Kinneys first lived in
different strokes, man.
The Kinneys first lived in a rented
Did you
home.
Get that? Dana Plato. What'd you talk about, Willis? What'd you talk about, Camille?
Okay, the Kinneys first lived in a rented home next to his parents, but soon a ranch-style home was built for them, and it was located at 17009 East 26th Terrace in Independence, Missouri.
Right.
I like to provide, because I think if I lived there, I'd be like, oh my gosh, that's by me, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, this is right outside of Kansas City.
Right. Correct.
Mm-hmm.
So, Kinney worked the night shift at Bendix, and his wife initially filled her days with shopping, lots and lots of shopping, and Sharon liked the finer things in life, but they really
couldn't
can't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, later, her shopping hobby was joined by another hobby of seeing other men.
Oh.
No, if it was today's world, it might be meth, but back then.
Okay, that was funny.
That was funny. When their second child arrived, Sharon was carrying on a regular affair with a friend she knew from high school.
Oh.
You're going to know this name. John Valdez. He's the one that helped find the body earlier.
Yeah. That's not suspicious
at all. James Kinney was becoming...
Juan Valdez?
No.
John Valdez. Okay. I was going to say, God, what coffee does to you, man. It is coffee, isn't it, Juan Valdez?
Yes. James Kinney was becoming increasingly upset by her spending habits, but he also started to suspect she had a boyfriend. During March of 1960, James spoke with his parents about the possibility of divorce and that Sharon had agreed to give him a divorce if he allowed her to keep the house and the couple's daughter and pay her $1,000.
A month or just?
I'm guessing a month. Yeah. Right?
That's a lot.
Not a year. Maybe just a flat rate.
In 1960s, that was a lot of money.
A lot of money.
And do Mormons, do they look down upon divorce like Catholics do? I'm not for sure. We need a mansplainer.
We do need a mansplainer. Sadly, his parents urged James to stay in the marriage. Bet they hated that, because, you know. According to Sharon Kinney, at around 5:30 p.m. on the evening of March 19th, she heard a gunshot from the direction of the bedroom in which her husband was sleeping. Entering the room, she found her young daughter, 2.5-year-old Dana, on the bed next to her father. Dana was holding one of James's guns, a .22 caliber high-standard semi-automatic target pistol.
Did this happen before or after the Lana Turner incident?
James was bleeding from an apparent gunshot wound in the back of the head. Kinney called the police, but James Kinney was dead by the time the ambulance arrived at the hospital.
My guess is she waited till she knew he was dead.
Of course she did. Mm-hmm. Kinney called the police, but James Kinney was dead by the time the ambulance arrived at the hospital. Oh.
Totally bet she waited until she knew he was dead.
Police attempted.
And why would a 2-year-old have access to a gun?
I'm glad you asked that. I bring that up too. You're awful psychic this episode.
Well, I've been working on it.
Good. Police attempted to get fingerprints from the pistol. However, the grip was well oiled and they could not get anything off of it. A paraffin test for the gunshot residues that would be performed normally on hands was not performed on the baby, Dana, or on Sharon Kinney.
Of course not. Why would they do that?
Okay, this lady's luck. It's like every time she's just lucky.
Like the last episode that we did with the Nathan Williams.
Lucky. While it seems strange that a little girl would play with her dad's guns, many friends and family told police that James had often allowed little Dana to play with them.
No.
Thank you.
Are you kidding me?
Nope.
It was the 60s.
It was, but come on. She's two.
And I mean, they didn't. That makes me angry. There were always loaded guns in the house. You know, I am from Missouri, but we always knew you never touch the gun.
Correct.
Never.
This was later proved as police arrived at the house and wanted to see if Dana could actually pull the trigger. 2.5 is pretty little. And to actually know where a trigger is on a gun and what you do with it.
My daughter's 10. My youngest one's 10. And she still can't, like, open bottles or she doesn't have the strength to do a lot of stuff.
Right. The police put the handgun in her hand. And Dana did, in fact, with no guidance from police, handled the gun, knew what she was doing, and was able to pull the trigger.
No way. At 2?
2.5. Yep. That was a little test that the police did to kind of see. So they gave her the gun to see what she would do and how do you shoot it. She did it.
Hopefully
she knew how to do it.
Unloaded.
Of course it was. Because
I don't know. Yeah. But some of these reports.
So with not much to go on, the police ruled the death of James Kinney an accidental homicide.
Unbelievable.
The gun was taken by police and was not given back to Sharon, even though Sharon wanted it returned and couldn't understand why the police wouldn't give it back to her. Find that so odd. If you had a loved one that was murdered by a weapon, would you want that weapon back?
Oh, of course I would. I would put it in a shadow box. No.
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 Later, she enlisted a friend to buy her a .22 caliber automatic pistol. She obviously likes the .22 caliber.
Wait, why would a friend buy it for her? Was it because she didn't want the police to know? Or was it back in the day?
Wait.
Because women couldn't
psychic again.
Women couldn't buy a car.
He complied and registered it under her name. She demanded he go back and re-register it under another name. Now you know why.
Okay. She didn't want anybody to know that it was registered to her.
Mm-hmm. I think that she'd branch out and get a different car. A different gun.
Okay. And 22s really? I guess 22 rifles really aren't that.
It's a pistol. It's a pistol.
Yeah, but I mean, whatever.
With the investigation into his death closed, James Kinney was buried and his wife collected on his life insurance policies, valued at about $29,000, which is $230,000 today, roughly.
Or one semester of college.
Yeah. So finding all this information out and having heard her name before with that case that was a little strange about the 2-year-old killing their dad on accident.
Right.
Investigators jump in and immediately question Sharon, James Baldies, and Walter Jones.
Finally.
Jones and Baldies, you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Both admit to have been dating Sharon.
At the same time?
Yes. They both agreed to a lie detector test. Kinney gave an oral statement. You're not going to say anything there?
No, I'm trying to be good.
Good girl. to police but declined to sign a written one or take a lie detector test. Both men passed the lie detector test.
Okay.
While the suspects were being questioned, the other investigators were concentrating on the crime scene. Authorities were trying desperately to find the bullet that had actually passed through Jones's body, as well as the murder weapon. They hadn't located that. I like this part. They even deployed Boy Scouts to search.
Okay, what match is that?
Could you imagine? Like, could you imagine Boy Scouts searching for a murder weapon? That would never happen today. Am I right?
Yeah, I wonder what the badge was that they would get.
What?
No, I'm serious. What kind of badge?
Soon, a .22 caliber rifle slug was eventually found, and it was buried in the ground near where Jones's body was discovered, providing evidence that at least some of her wounds had been sustained at the place her body was found.
Right. And you're probably correct that she dropped to her knees after the one shot to the head. And
I would think that. That's how it went up. So with great pride, as you can only imagine, the police finally think they have her. They have Sharon Kinney. She kind of got away with her husband's murder, but they think they can nail her for this. So Kinney was arrested at her home for the murder at around 11 p.m. on May 31st, the same night as Patricia Jones' funeral.
Oh.
It gets better. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
That same day, the Jackson County Sheriff requested that prosecutors consider a second charge of murder, this one for the death of her husband, James Kinney.
Ooh, good.
Right?
Good.
The next morning, her lawyers got her released on $20,000 bond while she awaited a prelim hearing originally scheduled for June.
Who put up the bond money? The lawyers, I guess.
Well, she's got that money, too. Police were able to rule out the .22 caliber pistol that had killed Kinney's husband as the murder weapon in Jones's death. All right, it gets better. Are you ready?
I am. Tell me.
The same day, the Jackson County Sheriff requested that prosecutors consider a second charge in the murder, this one for the death of James Kinney.
Good.
Right? The next morning, her lawyers got her released on a $20,000 bond while she awaited a prelim hearing originally scheduled for June. Police were able to rule out the .22 caliber pistol that had killed Kinney's husband as the murder weapon in Jones's death. That gun was still in possession of the sheriff's office. Remember, they took
it?
However, remember, there was her friend who she asked to buy her a gun.
Right.
But police were unable to locate that gun. But they did find an empty box that they believed once held the gun.
Yeah.
Kinney just simply stated that the gun must have disappeared.
Oh,
but she kept
that.
The box.
I wonder if little Dana took it.
The autopsy of Patricia Jones was botched.
No way.
Way. The doctor who did the autopsy, Dr. Owen, said he had recovered one of the presumed three bullets present in the body, and that because the body had been prepared by an undertaker prior to autopsy, any chemical test on the stomach contents would have been useless. Owens added, when asked, that he had not seen any food apparent in the stomach at autopsy. Any chemical test on the stomach contents would have been useless. Owens added that he had not seen any apparent food in the stomach at autopsy, that the body of Patricia Jones was now going to be exhumed on June 17th. They needed to collect the bullets that he had left behind, as well as gather any samples of tissue and stomach contents that were possible. And as you know, the stomach contents would dictate when she last ate, meaning the
time of death. Right.
Kinney's arraignment on July 11th resulted in a denial of bail.
Good.
But the Kansas City Court of Appeals struck down the ruling, later based on the prosecution's reliance on circumstantial evidence. Kinney was freed on $24,000. Now, mind you, that's about $188,000.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. Bond on July 18th. After a delay in her trial date due to her advanced pregnancy. Now, remember, she was supposed to be pregnant with Walter's baby.
Mm-hmm.
But funny enough, as, you know, people will, the news...
Right.
The community totally enthralled with this case.
Oh,
she was
pretty.
Was. She's pregnant on murder trial. You know, she carried that baby for over 10 months.
Oh, you know what? I think she might have lied about that.
I'm not sure, but I think maybe
I think so. I can't believe she'd lie.
Right?
She seems so upstanding. And...
Right. So Kinney gave birth to a daughter she named Marla Christine on January 16th, 1969. Facing trial and charged with both the murder of Patricia Jones and her late husband, James Kinney, Sharon Kinney was tried separately for the two murders.
Right.
Her trial for the murder of Patricia Jones began in mid-June 1961, and it had, interestingly enough, an all-male jury.
Ah, yeah. Well, you know, I wonder...
We need a mansplainer right now.
We do need, but, well, we actually don't this time because I do know that, well, we kind of do, because I do know that women weren't allowed on juries on all 50 states until 1973.
That's crazy.
But I don't know for sure when Missouri allowed it.
Crazy.
It's insane.
The prosecution was unable to firmly establish that Kinney owned or had once owned the weapon that killed Jones, though both Kinney's known pistols and the one that fired the bullets that killed Jones were, in fact, .22 caliber weapons.
Huh.
A man named Roy Thrush, who sold the pistol to Kinney's co-worker, he's the one that went and bought her the gun because she wanted one, led police to a tree that contained what he claimed to be the bullets that he had fired from the pistol when he was testing the gun prior to selling it. However, when the bullets were extracted from the tree trunk, tests showed that the extracted bullets were not identifiable as the one that came from the weapon that killed Jones. The tree had been, it was like on a shooting range or whatever, so it had a lot of bullets in it. So again, she's getting lucky.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The prosecution rested its case on June 21st after calling 27 witnesses. Kinney's defense, which took less than 2 days and involved 14 witnesses other than Kinney, she did not testify, focused on breaking down the state's claims of motive and means, arguing that Kinney had no reason... Right. To kill Jones, and that the .22 caliber pistol she was alleged to have owned at that time had not been proven to be the exact murder weapon.
Okay.
After slightly over 1.5 hours of deliberation. That's it. The jury, citing just too many loopholes left in the prosecution's case, found Kinney not guilty. Immediately after the delivery of the verdict, juror Ogden Stevens asked Kinney for her autograph.
No.
Which she was photographed doing and giving to him. Ugh. Kinney returned to jail the same day to await trial for the murder of her husband. Despite her acquittal in the case of the murder of Patricia Jones, Kinney remained under charges for the murder of her husband, James Kinney. When jury selection began on January 8, 1962, the jury was informed that the court was not going to indeed pursue the death penalty. The prosecution's case rested largely on the contention that Kinney had wanted her husband dead to collect life insurance on him. Here's an interesting tidbit. In fact, her other boyfriend, John Boldez, testified in a grand jury testimony earlier. He had claimed that Kinney offered him $1,000 in return to murder her husband. Ooh. But then later he recanted, saying it was just a joke.
Oh, just yeah, because that's what you do. You joke about joke that kind of stuff
in
to
a
the
grand,
police.
Grand jury testimony, yeah. Too. Don't forget that.
Well, duh. You further, gotta make it light. And
gotta keep it light.
Gotta
so
keep
serious,
it light.
Those judges hell? And stuff. Further testimony alleged that the Kinney marriage had been on the verge of divorce at the time of the husband's death. Sharon Kinney, being the adulterer, had been the cause of this, and that Sharon would, in fact, collect her husband's $29,000 in life insurance policy, but she had to remain his wife. A new divorce.
Yeah.
The defense focused on the circumstantial quality of the prosecution's evidence, noting that prior police investigation had determined James Kinney's death to be obviously accidental, and that the jury was obligated to assume innocence on the defendant's part, no matter how unpleasant they found her moral character to be. The defense, too, attacked the reliability of John Boldez's testimony, calling him a poor, mixed-up kid who would, quote, sign anything, end quote. Kinney's attorneys also presented testimony from witnesses supporting the viability of the theory that Dana Kinney had shot her father, including statements that guns had been regularly left within Dana's reach at the family home, that Dana was able to pull triggers on toy guns with stiffer trigger pulls than the weapon that caused Kinney's death.
And you almost wonder if she taught Dana how to do it.
And she might have.
That's sick.
The trial ended in conviction on January 11th after 5.5 hours of deliberation. In April of that same year, she was formally sentenced to life in prison. She began to serve her sentence in the Missouri Reformatory for Women. Despite the verdict, James Kinney's family continued to believe the best of their daughter-in-law, telling reporters on the day of the verdict, "We can't find it in our hearts to say anything bad about her, and we still don't feel that she committed murder." Kinney herself told reporters that she felt the verdict was a mistake and that she regretted her previous enthusiasm for having a woman on the jury. Right?
Traitor.
Now, something I'm going to add right here is that there was some sort of agreement, and I saw this in one thing and not another, that she agreed with his parents that they could have easy access to the child, to Dana, the baby, as long as they, in public, supported her.
See? Yeah, that's, there you go.
So she would, and that's exactly the...
That's exactly what happened.
...person she would be. The next week, Kenny's lawyers requested that she be released on bond, supported by a community petition signed by 132 supporters of her innocence. Mm-hmm. The motion was denied on the basis of first-degree murder not being a bailiful offense. Presiding Judge Tom J. Stubbs also counseled Kenny's lawyers and said that they felt their involvement in such a petition at a time when a motion for bond was being considered was highly improper. A subsequent defense motion requested that Kenny's conviction be vacated because the jury had delivered its verdict based on surmise and speculation rather than substantial evidence. The motion also listed a series of procedural errors that Kenny's counsel alleged had taken place before and during the trial, including a juror taking incomplete notes. Attorneys for both sides of the case having disputed John Boldez's testimony and an incorrect number of potential jurors being provided for selection. The motion was denied by Judge Stubbs in April 1962, but appealed to the Missouri Supreme Court, which in March 1963 reversed, this is this girl's luck, reversed Kenny's conviction and ordered a new trial on the basis of Kenny's defense having been denied adequate challenges during jury selection.
Adequate challenges?
I guess not good enough people, like, because it said that they had a shortage.
Yeah.
Kenny was denied an opportunity for bail in May 1963, but that ruling was overturned in July, and Kenny was released on $25,000 bond posted by her brother.
What?
Are they not learning not to let her go?
Well, the whole thing was, weren't they, she couldn't get bond because you can't do it for first degree murder, and wasn't that whole rigmarole that you just said, the whole...
Mm-hmm. The state's request that the Missouri Supreme Court reconsider its position on Kenny's conviction was granted. But in October 1963, that hearing resulted in further grounds being found for a new trial, this time on the basis of the prosecutor having been allowed to cross-examine a prosecution witness. A second request for the rehearing on the validity of Kenny's conviction was denied by the Missouri Supreme Court. Kenny and her children moved in with their mother and awaited the start of her new trial.
Ugh.
Are you keeping count on the trial update here?
No, yeah, it's ridiculous. Ridiculous.
Kenny's second trial, that's what we're up to now, right now, for the murder of James Kenny began on March 23rd, 1964. As jury selection got underway that day, the public was initially barred from the proceedings, but the restriction was soon loosened and the media were allowed into the courtroom.
Oh,
now, like I mentioned earlier, here's an attractive lady. We've got murder, mayhem, money. I mean, you name it.
It's the perfect storm.
Infidelity. Yeah. An unusually long jury selection process made the day, the first day of trial, last 14 hours, starting at 9 a.m. The judge had decided that the case was so notorious throughout that area that either he had to sequester the potential jury pool, which would be a lot of people, or just continue, muddle through, get it, and be done with it.
Or a lot of money, could you imagine?
The eventual jury, all men,
of course,
were immediately sequestered. But days later, a mistrial was declared after it emerged that a law partner of prosecutor Lawrence Gephardt had once been retained by one of the jurors. So what are we up to now? Are we counting?
Three, isn't it?
Well, four if you count.
Four.
Patricia Domes. Kenny's third trial for the murder of her husband was originally scheduled to begin in early June 1964, but instead began on June 29th. Assistant prosecutor Donald L. Mason declared at jury selection that he intended to death qualify the jury, a process in which a prosecutor challenges any juror who automatically opposes the death penalty, and jury selection once again took more than 12 hours and a day. John Boldez's testimony in the trial remained contradictory as to whether he believed Kenny's offer had been intended seriously. That was the offer to kill the husband.
Right.
But added this time that after James Kenny's death, Sharon Kenny had asked him to not tell authorities about her $1,000 offer of the death of her husband. A new witness, a female acquaintance of Kenny's, testified that Sharon Kenny had once joked that the woman should get rid of the woman's old man like Kenny did.
Oh.
But defense cross-examination highlighted inconsistencies between this testimony and a similar quote the woman had offered at a previous deposition. For the first time at any of her trials, Kinney took the stand on the last day of this trial to issue a categorical denial of all charges.
Of course she denied it.
You ready? Mm-hmm. The all-male jury deadlocked 7-5 in a favor of the acquittal, resulting in a second mistrial. What are we up to now? Yeah, you're right.
Five?
A fourth trial. That's right. Count them. 1, 2, 3, 4. A fourth trial in the death of James Kinney was scheduled for October 1964. However, in September of 1964, Kinney, still freed on her $25,000 bond, decided to travel to Mexico with an alleged lover.
Oh, did she ever return?
Francis Samuel Puglisi left her children with James Kinney's father and traveled as Puglisi's wife under the name Jeanette. The couple later said that they had come to Mexico to get married. Under the legal terms of her bail, Kinney was permitted to leave the country, but her contract with the company that posted her bond prohibited her from leaving Missouri without written permission from the company's agents. After crossing the border, the couple registered at a local hotel, Hotel Gin, again as husband and wife. Kinney saying that she felt unsafe in the foreign country, bought a pistol. Yep, you heard me. Bought a pistol, which meant that the couple now possessed multiple guns, having bought one or two from the United States with them.
Because, Lord.
On the night of September 18th, 1964, Kinney left the hotel.
Don't tell me something happens to Francis.
On the night of September 18th, 1964, Kinney left the house without Puglisi, either to acquire money because the couple was running low or to get medicine she required. Kinney encountered Francesco Paradisi Ordanez, a Mexican-born American citizen, at a bar that night and accompanied him back to his room in Hotel La Veda. According to Kinney's account, she went with Ordanez to see photographs he offered to show her. So on the night of September 18th, 1964, Kinney left the hotel without Puglisi, either to acquire money or because the couple was running low or to get medicine she required. Kinney encountered Francesco Paradisi Ordanez, a Mexican-born American citizen, at a bar that night and accompanied him back to his room in Hotel La Veda. According to Kinney's account, she went with him to see photographs he offered to show her, but he soon began to make sexual advances toward her, and she was forced to fire her gun at him in an attempt to protect herself. Shocker! Kinney maintained later that she had had no intention of killing him or harming him and had intended only to frighten him, but her bullets stuck him in the chest and killed him. Funny how that works when you point a gun at somebody and pull the trigger and shoot them and it goes into their chest. Yeah, it's going to stick and yeah, they're going to be hurt. Hotel employees entered the room. Kinney fired again and hit one of the employees in the shoulder. Wounded, the employee fled the room, locking Kinney inside, and called the police. Police, rejecting Kinney's story, theorized that she had gone out that evening intended robbery and had chosen Ordanez as her victim. When he resisted her orders to give her his money, police believed Kinney shot him. So police responded to the hotel, arrested Kinney on charges of homicide and assault with a deadly weapon. Kinney maintained that she had not intended to harm Ordanez, merely to frighten him, and that when she fired the weapon at the employee, it was because she feared he, too, was coming to attack her. What? Okay. Yeah, exactly. Police searched Kinney's purse, finding a gun and 50 shells, and then the couple's room at the Hotel Gin, where they had found two more guns and another supply of shells. Authorities took Francis into custody there, initially holding him without charge, and later filing charges of entering the country illegally and carrying an unlicensed gun. Lord, the gun found in the couple's room that night was later proven through ballistics to be the same gun that killed Patricia Jones in 1960. But because Kinney had already been acquitted of the crime, she could not be charged again based on new
jeopardy
evidence. Correct. Puglisi was held, and while he was being held, Kinney was initially placed in a woman's prison.
Was he held tenderly?
Yes, he was. But then was just then transferred into the same facility that held her. The couple were arraigned on August 26th and held for trial. In October, Kinney's attorney had filed It's a document, but it's similar to the writ of habeas corpus, asserting that Mexico was violating Kinney's constitutional rights by holding her for a shooting committed in self-defense. Huh. The request was denied, and both Kinney and Puglisi were tried in the summer of 1965. He was cleared of the charges against him and deported to the United States, but Kinney was convicted on October 18th of the homicide. Despite rumors that she would receive probation and be deported, like her boyfriend, Kinney was instead sentenced to a 10-year prison term for the crimes when she officially was notified of the sentence the next day. She asserted that she would appeal her conviction. Kinney was returned to the women's prison to serve her sentence. There, she was nicknamed La Pistolera, the gunfighter, or the female gunfighter, woman gunfighter. A nickname subsequently adopted by the Mexican press. Boy, the press loves monikers, don't they?
They really do love monikers.
Kinney's appeal, rather than overturning her sentence, lengthened it. The three-man superior court, which heard her case, overturned one aspect of her conviction, charges of attempted robbery, but upheld her murder conviction and increased her sentence from 10 to 13 years,
wow,
saying that her original sentence had been too lenient. All right.
I've never...
Here's where the good part happens.
Really? Like there doesn't seem to be a good part at all.
Or
at least not for anybody besides Sharon.
Not her. That's what I mean. Yeah. On December 7th, 1969, Kinney was not present for a routine 5 p.m. roll call at the prison where she was serving her sentence, and her absence was not officially noted until she failed to show up at a second roll call later that evening. The news of her disappearance was not reported to Mexico City police until 2 a.m. the following morning.
What?
Yep. A manhunt was then arranged, initially focusing on the northern Mexican states due to the authorities' belief that Kinney may have been heading for her last known whereabouts of a former inmate to whom she'd grown close while they were in prison together.
Like, close?
I don't know how close. American authorities, including the FBI, were also alerted of Mexican authorities' belief that Kinney may have been attempting to work her way back into her native country, but the FBI noted that it was unlikely to have jurisdiction in this case. Initial police speculation was that Kinney had bribed guards to look the other way while she escaped prison. An unusual blackout had been reported at the prison on the evening of and at the approximate time of her escape. An investigation showed that a door that should have been locked and left secured was in fact unsecured. But further questioning of prison guards and administration showed that the oversight of the prison was generally lax and that it was staffed by fewer guards than it should have been. News reports at the time reported numerous theories about Kinney's escape, including that she had bribed prison guards and that she may have enlisted help of a supposed boyfriend who was a Mexican City policeman, that Kinney's mother had been involved in the escape plan, that a former Mexican Secret Service agent had assisted in her escape, that Kinney may have disguised herself as a man to escape.
Yeah, it could be.
A more modern theory speculates that the family of Francisco Paradis Ardentes helped her escape and then killed her, which they could have.
They could have.
The intensive manhunt for Kinney was short-lived, however. By December 18th, the Mexican Secret Service and the Mexico City District Attorney's Office were both reporting that they were no longer involved in searching for the escaped prisoner.
Why?
Federal District Attorney was reporting that responsibility for the hunt belonged to the City District Attorney's Office. Investigators speculated that Kinney had already crossed the border from Mexico into Guatemala, making the point of a Mexican manhunt.
He can't do it. Yeah.
Not happening.
Wow.
But they noted that Kinney was fluent in Spanish after her years in a Mexican prison, which is true. I'm sure she would be. And she could therefore be getting along rather well in any Spanish-speaking area. Despite vowing to keep the case open and their investigating running until Kinney was back in custody, by the end of December 1969, authorities were forced to admit that they had run out of investigative leads to pursue.
Wow.
Fast forward to today. More than 40 years after her escape, Kinney remains at large.
Wow. How old would she be now?
I don't do math. Hold on. Her whereabouts, obviously, are still not unknown. Right. We don't even know if anything happened to her. Kinney's arrest and conviction in Mexico had implications for the status of her Missouri legal entanglements. Because she was being held in Mexico on October 26, 1964, the scheduled date for the fourth trial of the murder in her husband, Kinney's $25,000 bond was revoked. So she never showed up for that fourth trial of the murder of her husband.
Well, I would hope that would be
revoked. The United States Bond Insurance Company, which had posted the bond, argued that paperwork irregularities rendered the issuance of Kinney's bail illegal. The court ordered the company to forfeit the bond. Kinney was reportedly concerned about the monetary implications of this forfeiture. "I could always use the money," the Times Democrat quoted her as saying. "I don't intend to spend all of my life in jail," end wow. quote.
She'd be 78, by the way.
A $30,000 bond was issued August 1965 as the United Bond Insurance Company continued to dispute the payment of Kinney's original $25,000 bond. The bond allowed the company to defer payment of the $25,000 bond until the ruling on the matter was handed down by the Missouri Supreme Court. But when that court upheld the bond's forfeiture, the $25,000 was paid to the state of Missouri in October 1965. The United Bond Insurance Company later filed suit against Kinney's family to recover the cost of the bail, lawyer's fees, and for searching for Kinney after the escape. Shortly before her scheduled Missouri trial date, Kinney's Missouri counsel filed a motion to change the venue. I know I laughed there. Change the venue of any eventual fourth trial in the death of James Kinney, claiming that news coverage of Kinney's cases were so prejudiced and they had prejudiced the residents of Jackson County against her that it would be impossible for her to get a fair trial. See how cute they are? They're thinking they're going to find her again.
I would suspect that the entire state of Missouri had heard about her.
The country, Mexico, yeah. too. Unreal. When Kinney failed to appear for the murder of her husband, a warrant was issued for her arrest in October 1964. It is still outstanding all these years later, making it the oldest outstanding murder warrant known to exist in the Kansas City area.
Wow.
Kinney's status in the Mexican system also remains outstanding, though authorities have pointed out that at the time of her escape, jailbreak was not a crime under Mexican law. If she were recaptured there, she would only have to serve out the remainder of her outstanding sentence. Is that crazy or what?
That's insane.
So, as of 2012, Sharon Kinney's daughters, Dana and Marla, were still alive and living normal lives.
Right.
Kinney's son died several years ago. So, what do you think? You think she's alive, or you think she's in Mexico? You think she died? What do you think?
Well, she'd be 78 or 79.
But do you think that they let her escape to kill her?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
I really don't. I think she just
think
used her feminine.
Crafty.
Yep. I think she used her feminine wiles to just escape.
Yep.
And
I agree.
Maybe tried to hook up with some rich person in Mexico, one that was very affluent, and maybe took off to another country, like a European country. I mean, there's tons of places she could be.
Totally agree.
She wouldn't have to stay in Mexico.
I like to think she's still alive only because it's crazy.
It's
a crazy story.
Crazy. It's fun to see her get her final comeuppance, but...
Yeah, it's not going to happen.
No, it won't. Wow. That's amazing. Bizarre case.
Very.
It was a mouthful. You did a great job.
It was a long case.
Very good.
Thanks.
Interesting.
So... Tell the people how they can, if they love us, what they can do.
Oh, well, first you can like and subscribe. And then you can leave us a little review, maybe 5 stars, maybe a little write something, something. Another thing that you can do is you can tweet us. We are at True Crime Pod. We also have an email, which is ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook. We have a little page there. And our blog. You can find us at www.ourtruecrimepodcast.com.